I might say there's going to be prophetic matter that I am involved in, probably someplace along the line. I'll disagree with you on some item in each someplace. But that's the way it is with prophetic matters. We all have different shaped minds, and we share thoughts. But when I do speak on prophetic matters, and about half of my talk will be prophetic, the other won't. When I do speak on prophetic matters, I always say, if it doesn't happen that way, it's going to be better. Instead of one subject, I'll just briefly state the areas we hope to cover by the Lord's grace. We will deal with Theodore Herzl's work to try to form the Jewish state. But before Herzl, there's a saying out there. Before Herzl, there was Russell. And that's true. Before Herzl, there was Brother Russell. And his effort to, back in 1883, to have Baron Rothschild and Hirsch develop a plan to create a Jewish state. And we're going to deal with a gigantic work of Brother Russell with the Jewish people in Eastern Europe that most of the brethren are actually unaware of. Also, we will deal with prophecies and startling events to show that there is agreement by over 40% of the people in the United States, even atheists, that our world or civilization will be destroyed within the next 150 years. Well, there might be some overlap at times between Brother Rick and my talk. Couldn't have an overlap with a more wonderful brother. Brother Rick and I get along very well together. Yesterday was Sunday, and yesterday in Bethlehem, the capital of the Palestinian state, the Palestinian part of the land of Israel, the Pope, Pope Francis, was in Bethlehem. And the Pope made a gesture of apologizing to Theodore Herzl. Pope Francis observed that Theodore Herzl, back in his work to try to get the Jews to go back to Israel, that he visited the Vatican. He asked Pope Pius X to help establish a modern Jewish state. The historic homeland of the Jewish people. And Pope Pius rejected the request unless Herzl guaranteed that the Jewish state would be Christian. Now Pope Francis plans to visit Herzl's tomb on Mount Herzl in Jerusalem and place a wreath on the grave as a sign of apology and a request for forgiveness. And this Pope's visit is surrounded by controversy from its very beginning, as it starts with a stop in the Palestinian Authority-controlled Bethlehem in a move hailed by Arab sources as a very important recognition of Palestine as an independent state. Okay, before Herzl, there was Russell. Actually, back in about 1883, as mentioned in the early reprint, Brother Russell wrote Baron Hirsch and Baron Rothschild and gave them a plan how they could pay for the transition of 3 million Jews to in Russia to the Holy Land, and gave a detailed plan how that those Jews in the Holy Land could set up a Jewish state. Rothschild and Hirsch didn't respond. But if they did, the plan was practical. And if they did, there would have been a Jewish state before Hitler came on the stage. And the Jews would have had a haven, a Jewish state to flee to escape Hitler's persecution. Remember the prophecy on the hunters? Remember Hitler slaughtered the Jews, over 6 million Jews. And we feel this was a part of the hunter prophecy, fulfillment of the hunter prophecy that we have in Jeremiah 16:16. And that prophecy deals with hunters and fishers. And a good example of the fishers was Herzl. In 1896, he had a Zionist Congress in which he wanted to start a Zionist movement that would end up with a Jewish state. But it didn't work out. Then Brother Russell and I'm going to try to show now how the hunters just didn't refer to Hitler's persecution. Brother Russell observed that the hunters were active in the 1897 in the severe persecution of the Jews in Russia. So we feel that the term hunter doesn't just specifically refer to Hitler's work. It refers to any mass persecution and attempt to destroy the Jewish people. And we believe Europeans today are fast becoming hunters. In France, Jews are very oppressed and killed. You know, they have yarmulkes. They won't dare have their yarmulkes in sight. They always wear a hat or a covering over their yarmulkes because they know if they have a yarmulke walking down the street, they're going to be attacked. And this isn't just, we read about it, this year, but it's not just this year. This actually began in earnest about 3 years ago. So consequently, large numbers of Jews have been fleeing France for Israel. Then we have, an extreme example of anti-Semitism in Ukraine and in Hungary, where they are very anti-Semitic. And to make a long story short, Jewish leaders in Europe, now these are Jewish leaders, prominent Jewish leaders, they are predicting that in the next several years, that all the Jews in Europe will flee for their lives. We'll see. It's not my prediction. In a number of ways, in my work, endeavoring to change secular Jews in Israel to biblical Zionists. And we run newspaper ads, and we run articles in the Israeli papers. This happens to be the Jerusalem Post, where I have this full-page article. And the purpose of the newspaper ads and these articles is to, it offers the book to embrace your Jewish heritage. And its purpose is to turn secular Israelis into biblical Zionists. And whenever we do run an ad, we get 150 responses at least. And Sister Connie Campbell in Israel mails out the booklets to the response. Now I'm going to be dealing with Psalms 126 for a particular reason. So I'll just quote the first three verses that are involved in this psalm. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Israel, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter. Our tongue was shouts of joy. Then it was said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us, and we rejoice. Now this is the English rendition of Psalms 126, the first three verses. And now we're going to deal with a fantastic man in my sight, which doesn't mean too much, I guess, and the important role he, Rabbi Hannah Peratt, played for the Bible students. When Rabbi Hannah Peratt, a Zionist giant in Israel, died in 2011, more than 10,000 people of Israel attended his funeral. Very, very few Israeli leaders over the years have had a larger funeral than this. So this shows just how prominent and important Rabbi Peratt was. Now, in the Lord's providence, I've taken two groups over to Israel. And I guess it was our second one in 1996. In the Lord's providence, Rabbi Peratt addressed our group in the reception hall of Israel's Knesset or legislature. It would just be like a reception hall in Congress someplace. But Peratt observed that Bible students not only read the Bible, but believe, quote, the Bible was today's newspaper headlines written centuries ago, unquote. Obviously, he was building up to something. He quoted Psalms 126, verses 1 through 3. And he accentuated what he observed were the subtleties of the Hebrew text that are not contained in the English text. Peratt quoted, quote, when the Lord gathered the Jewish people to their homeland, and this was in the 1880s through the 1900s, he went on to say, they were like dreamers. That is, the Jewish people that went to Israel, they were like dreamers. That is, they didn't know what it's all about. And he continued, verses 2 and 3, speak of a people, Gentiles, who tell the nations what great things the Lord is doing for the regathered Jews. And they also tell us, Jews, what great things the Lord is doing for us. Then Peratt pointed to the brethren in the audience, and he said, you, the Bible students, are the ones that have told and are telling the world and Israel the things the Lord is doing for Israel. And we Jews are so glad. He said, quote, we appreciate so much what the Bible students are doing for us. And among the brethren in that audience, there wasn't an eye that wasn't filled with tears. How thrilling. According to the highly esteemed Rabbi Peratt, it was the Bible students, starting from Pastor Russell's time to our time, who revealed to the Jewish people the reason they as a people should return to the land of Israel. Rabbi Peratt was inspired by Brother Russell's explanation of Israel's place in God's plan. Peratt, in turn, inspired thousands of Jews to leave their home and go to Israel for the rest of their lives and settle, especially in Yesha, the so-called West Bank. Now, why would Peratt make this claim that Bible students revealed to the Jewish people what the regathering of the Jews of the land of Israel really meant? Peratt realized that in fulfillment of Psalms 126, 1 through 3, Brother Russell's message was not only heard by Jews in Peratt's day, but Brother Russell also conducted a harmonious, or rather a humongous, proclamation of a special message to the Jewish people, of which the Hippodrome speech of comfort to 500 Jews in 1910 was only the beginning. Now we're going to deal with aspects of that great proclamation by Brother Russell from the Hippodrome onward, especially from 1912 to 14 in Eastern Europe. And this is, as I say, not well known among the brethren. But it's briefly mentioned in the reprints as Die Stimme. D-I-E, capital S-T-I-M-M-E. I reprint page 47, 43. We learn Brother Russell published, quote, a large edition of the newspaper, Die Stimme, which contained Jerusalem news and reports of several Brother Russell's sermons to the Jews, unquote. Brother Russell goes on to observe, Die Stimme was very accepted amongst the Jews, quote, that it does not point them to Jesus of Nazareth, unquote, but it points them to the land of Palestine and the near establishment of Messiah's kingdom, where their national blessings will begin. And this is a quote from Brother Russell. And Brother Russell further absorbed, quote, just at this juncture, divine providence seemed to bless our message to the Jews. Most remarkably, the message has been scattered all over the world, partly by Jewish journals interested in the message and partly by those that opposed it, but especially in Eastern Europe. Nevertheless, the voice, that's what Die Stimme means, the voice Die Stimme has gone forth to the ends of the earth. Brother also goes on to say, God's message to the Jews is being heard the world around, quote, and this is a quote, not only several of our sermons to the Jews published to the extent of 107,600 copies in Jewish papers in the English language, but in 655,000 copies in the Yiddish papers, besides 325,000 copies of Die Stimme. Brethren, just think of it. Brother Russell had over 1 million brochures circulated throughout the Jewish communities in Europe, especially in Poland and Russia, encouraging the Jewish people to return to their homeland and prepare for the part they would play in God's plan. These brochures became so popular that they were even sold at newsstands in Poland and in Russia. In another place, the pastor quoted, observed, quote, the message to them now is, to the Jewish people, the message to them now is that their period of chastisement is at an end, and that shortly divine blessing will come to them, not as Christians, but as Jews, unquote. As we observed, over a million brochures containing Brother Russell's message of comfort to the Jewish people has been distributed to the Jewish people throughout the world. Now, who carried out this work in Europe for Brother Russell? Brother Russell needed a brother that was fluent in the Polish language and the Russian languages to personally direct this work in Eastern Europe. We don't think in terms of a Polish class, Bible student class, having been in Chicago back in Brother Russell's day, but there was. There was a Brother Olszewski, who was leading a small Polish class in Chicago. Brother Russell sent him to Europe to direct this Dyskami work. Another unknown fact was that there were several small classes in Poland. We never think of classes being in Poland, Bible student classes being in Poland way back in Brother Russell's day, but there were. And Brother Olszewski worked with them in the publication and distribution of Dyskami years later, just to follow through on Brother Olszewski. Years later, around 1918, he became the leader of the so-called Polish Free Brethren in the United States. And the above quotes can be found in the Overland Monthly, and I do have a copy to be up here if anybody wants to look at it. The details of the Dyskami work, and it's covered, as I say, in the reprints and in the Overland Monthly. Okay, we're going to move on. You notice we have a lot of subheadings to go in a little different direction. Brother Russell's expectations concerning the Jews from the land of the north finally realized. Remember, Brother Russell, as we observed from Jeremiah 16, 14, and 15, that the Jews in his day would immigrate to Russia, the land of the north, and immigrate from Russia, the land of the north, and settle in the land of Israel. Well, it never happened back then. But in our day, March of 1993, Russia was forced by world pressure to let the Jews living in Russia, who were living there under great persecution, Russia was forced to permit the Jews in Russia to migrate to Israel. That same month, I had a meeting with Prime Minister Rabin of Israel. I was accompanied into his office with two newspaper reporters and a translator. And as we're going into the office, one of the reporters leaned over and she says, 20 minutes in and out. Prime Minister Rabin was completely laid back, willing to hear everything we had to say. Actually, we were in his office with him for an hour and a half. And I mentioned to him that in the next 10 years, the permission for the Russian Jews to go to Israel had just began in 1993. And I said that I expected on the basis of Bible prophecy that over a million Russian Jews would immigrate to Israel. He laughed and said, as we get 200,000, we'll be doing good. About 5 months later, I was reading the speech that Rabin had just given. In the speech, he said that when he was reelected, he was going to turn Israel's economy around so that they could absorb 1 million Russian Jews. In the next 10 years, brethren, it happened. By 1997/98, over 1 million Russian Jews had immigrated to Israel in fulfillment of this prophecy. Now we're going to go in an entirely different direction for a while into non-Israel areas or non-Jewish areas. We're going to deal with the end of the world. Bible students are no longer the only ones preaching the end of the world. Nominal Christians and even atheists, 41% of them, including the atheists, believe our civilization will be destroyed in 150 years. Now, where do you get these predictions? From the Barna Group poll, and the Barna Group poll is considered one of the most accurate poll takers in the country. According to the 2013 Barna Group poll, of all the adults in the United States, 54% of Protestants and 77% of evangelical Protestants expected our civilization to fall apart within 150 years. Also, 45% of practicing Catholics the world over believe that we are now living in end times. But most startling is, as I said, over 41% of all participants in this poll, every religion, even atheists, said conditions in the world are so severe, we are in the biblical end times. Unquote. Incredible. It has been observed that there's never been a poll like this on end times. It sparked sparked unprecedented preaching by evangelicals and, of course, Billy Graham. Now, just following this line of reasoning of possible destruction of civilization, there is a book written by Brzezinski in... couple years ago, and his book was Out of Control. Brzezinski observed that the 20th century became the century of insanity, in which 175 million were slaughtered in the name of politics of organized insanity, is the way he put it, unquote. It is horrific, he said. 175 million were slaughtered in one century because of mankind's hate, greed, and ruthless craze for power. Today, all the deaths from natural causes all the deaths from natural disasters in the 20th century, and what do you have? A drop in the bucket. Compared to man's killing machine, 175 million slaughtered within so-called civilization of our world. It is natural deaths are a drop in the bucket, as he said, compared to this killing machine. Now another 21st century potential disaster. Just last week, the White House issued a global warning alarm. Now, there used to be so many challenges to the concept of global warming, and I'm sure there still are, but they're the extreme minority now. In this global warming alarm, it says, global warming spells utter disaster unless something is done immediately to control it, end of quote. This is a part of the time of trouble and tribulation that Daniel predicted in Daniel 12:1 and Matthew 24 that we're well aware of, that will destroy the evil present order, the social order, and usher in that precious time, the third world and then the world without end. Now we're going to consider, under the heading, Cities Could Disappear. And this is lifting quotes out from the Huffington Press or Post, which is one of the most popular and considered the best online newspapers. According to the noted Huffington Post, 14 U.S. cities could disappear over the next century due to rising tides. For example, quote, if Hurricane Sandy struck Boston during high tide, 6.6% of the city would have been flooded. Water would have reached the steps of City Hall. Within 100 years, it goes on to say, that could become the new norm. Twice a day, Hurricane Sandy gave New Yorkers just a taste of what might happen to their city over the next 100 years. According to the new data released in June, the sea level would rise 4 to 8 inches in New York over just the next 10 years, a 5-foot rise during the next 100 years in sea level would submerge LaGuardia and many parts of New York City and a significant portion of Manhattan, unquote. Then the Huffington Post gives examples of 12 other major cities to show how the United States and other nations in turn, it says, would be devastated in the next 100 years. And the cities that they mentioned that would be most highly affected would be Miami, Florida, Atlantic City, New Jersey, Lauderdale, Florida, Honolulu, Hawaii, New Orleans, Sacramento, Los Angeles, Charleston, Savannah, Seattle, Washington, Virginia Beach, San Diego. They would be affected the most. But other cities would be affected also, not only in this country, but in other parts of the world. Now, this is incredible. In the United States and other nations, they are predicting that cities will be devastated in the next 100 years. What time do we go to?
12:30.
Okay. Okay, now I'm going to get very elementary. Because it considers one of our best scriptures to teach the two salvations, And we let our now in the church friends turn it around to nullify it. And this is John 5, 28 and 29. The hour is coming now is, and I'm trying to quote it by and now is in which, no, that's not it. I'm quoting wrong. I'm in a different scripture. All right, John 5. Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in their graves shall hear his voice, and shall come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they that have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. And that's the King James version. And most translations say there will be the resurrection, of course, of the good to a resurrection of life, and they that have done evil, most translations say, to a resurrection of judgment. Well, judgment means one thing to you, and it means another thing to our nominal church people. So we want to show how we can use this scripture to teach the salvation, two salvations, without they're countering it. Okay, this word judgment, come forth to a resurrection of judgment, not damnation. But what does judgment mean? Our nominal church friends say, sure. They that have done evil will come forth to a resurrection of judgment. They'll sit before the judgment seat of Christ, and he'll review their past life. And because it was so evil, they'll go to hell. So they take one of our best scriptures to prove the two salvations and turn it around to continue their viewpoint. All right, they will come forth to a resurrection of judgment. And that word judgment in the Greek Krino. That's right. And in the Greek, it's capital, with capital K. But that word has been used not only in the Greek, but it has been turned to English with, instead of a capital K, a C. The word crisis. And the word crisis has become a universal word. And it's spelled the same way as our Greek word here in the Bible, the English text. And in the Greek text, as we say, it's the capital K. But whenever it's used in the English language and throughout the world, it has the thought spelling with a C. And what does crisis mean? They that have done evil will come forth to a resurrection of crisis. Their resurrection after they're raised, that will be their crisis time. How is the word crisis used? You know, after World War II, when they tried to form many new governments in Europe, each government fell many times, and there'd be headlines, the Italian government in crisis, the Russian government in crisis, the British government in crisis. Does that mean that that government was going to go out of office? No. It simply meant that the crisis time is the turning point. You know, a doctor will say about a patient, he's going to reach his crisis tomorrow. He doesn't mean that tomorrow that patient's going to live definitely or that patient's going to die definitely. But tomorrow will be the time when the matter can go either way. And I'm thrilled with all the Indians, the Chinese use the word crisis. Because, you know, the Chinese don't have an alphabet. It's all symbols. So the way they spell or define crisis in the Chinese language is one symbol that denotes opportunity. The other symbol is danger. Crisis is a danger time because although things could get better, they could also get worse. So, in our scripture, the world of mankind, the evil class will come forth to a resurrection of crisis. The turning point in their life where they can take a stand for righteousness and gain eternal life, or they can continue in their unrighteous way and gain eternal death. And I just wanted to share that with you. All right. I'm going to say something that will probably surprise you. Some might feel that we're going on a new subject. Some might feel that I'm just too enthusiastic about Israel. Ken Rossen, yeah, he's overboard on Israel. I'm going to say something that will surprise you. My view of Israel is ambivalent. Yes, Israel is now the top nation in the world in technology. Plus, Israel has helped other nations in their disasters and in their troubles more than any other country. Many of Israel's inventions, special medical inventions, are life-saving. For instance, there's no definite cure for cancer, but Israel has developed it to the extent that if a patient or a person comes down with cancer once and revives, with this medication, they will never, never have cancer again. If they survive the first case of cancer with this medication, they will never die of cancer. Quite a feat. So, in many respects, Israel is a remarkable, especially remarkable country for its size. But, as a government, I call Israel a banana republic. You know what a banana republic is, you know, the South American countries are called banana republics. And Israel's government is often motivated by expediency, by self-interest, and even dishonesty at times. I have to admit it. I'm ready to admit it. Good example. Now, Olmert, a former prime minister, a person I knew very well, who said to me, "When I'm prime minister, we'll never give an inch of the land of Israel to the Arabs." But then he was indicted, and he became one of the most compromising prime ministers in Israel. And then he is indicted on other charges, and now he's going to serve 6 years prison. The previous president of Israel has just been released from a 4-year prison term. And the present president of Israel, Peres, and of course, The president of Israel has no power. He's a figurehead, but an important figurehead. And then I won't make my comments on Perez and Netanyahu and Rabin, but I have my reservations very definitely, because they're all imperfect. So, actually, I think I'm quite realistic on my view of current Israel. They're going to have to go through a lot of chastening before they will be ready to be the nation that the Lord would use in blessing all the families of the earth. Okay, we want to turn to Jeremiah 31. and we'll deal with verses 11, 14, 15, and 16. And we're getting into the field that all her lovers will forsake her. You know, brethren have always had a very definite idea that this prophecy is being fulfilled now, and all the nations will forsake Israel, her lovers, those that are cooperating and supporting her. But I've always had trouble with this prophecy. Because in this prophecy, Israel's committing some great sin. And we don't think of Israel sitting, having some great, as the scriptures, verse 12 says, incurable sin. And I often wonder, what is this great sin that Israel has at this time? So I'll read four verses here. Verse 11. For I am with thee, saith the Lord, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations, whither I have scattered thee, yet I will not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure. Verse 14. All thy lovers have forsaken thee. They seek thee not. For I have wounded thee with the wound of an enemy, and with the chastisement of a cruel one, for the multitude of thine iniquities, thy sins, because thy sins were increased. In verse 16, therefore all they that devour thee shall be devoured. Well, we'll leave that one. What's this great sin that Israel is committing when all her lovers forsake her? Before we get to that great sin, we'll just deal with all her lovers forsake her. And most brethren feel that between now and the invasion of Gog, that all of her lovers, all of the nations that are supporting her will turn on her, and that even the United States will turn on her between now and the time that the invasion of Gog of Magog takes place. Okay, now, verse 15, or 14, is referring to Ezekiel 38, verses 11, and Ezekiel 39, verse 26. Beginning with verse 25, and this takes up after the invasion is over and the Lord finally fights for Israel and Israel is delivered. Now, verse 25 says, therefore, thus saith the Lord God, now I will bring the captivity of Jacob and this is from the literal Hebrew, I will bring the captivity of Jacob to an end and have mercy upon the whole house of Israel and will be zealous for my holy name. After that they have borne their shame and all their trespasses, whereby they have trespassed against me, when they dwelt safely in their land, and none made them afraid. Here Israel is predicted that when they're dwelling safely in their land, and none will make them afraid, that they will be committing some great transgression. The phrase, dwelling safely in the land, all of a sudden ringed a bell in my mind. I've read this umpteen times. But it says, when they dwelt safely in the land. Well, that very phrase is used in Ezekiel 38, 11th verse. And thou sayest, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages, and I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, and all them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey, etc. And my chairman is here. So, you know what? My next talk will be All Her Lovers Will Forsake Her. And if anybody would like to look at what Brother Russell did in his great campaign of Thy Stebby, in which over a million publications were published in Russia, in Europe and Russia, to give a message to the Jews. The Lord bless you all.